Welcome once again to our series, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages. My guest again is Ron Eldred, teacher at John Paul II Catholic High in apologetics and Bible. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, pastor emeritus at St. Patrick's at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the streets. We're talking, this is our 30th section on interpreting the Bible, and the background, of course, is that as Catholics, we believe that the Church is the mother of the Bible. The Church put the Bible together at the Council of Carthage in 397, and the Vatican Council Dei Verbum document told us as Catholics, go back to the rich black earth of the nourishment from the sacred word of God in both the Old and the New Testament. And they quoted St. Jerome, the great biblical scholar, as saying, to be ignorant of the scriptures is to be ignorant of Christ. So that anything we can learn about the Bible to help us appreciate this marvelous treasure, the greatest and most important book in the world that God has given us, We hope that it helps our listeners, too, to appreciate the complexity of the Scriptures and how so much both faith and reason come in to trying to clarify and understand the true teachings of the sacred Scripture. Ron, we've gone through several historical periods, the Protestant Reformation, the Enlightenment, which we're up to now, last part of the 17th century, first part of the 18th century, about how biblical scholarship was developing both among Catholics and Protestants. So we've been talking about some of the philosophers and biblical scholars in this age of Enlightenment. We got up to Thomas Hobbes, and which I mentioned about how he was influenced, how he influenced changing biblical scholarship.
Well, Hobbes, who lived from 1588 to 1679, was perhaps the first philosopher whose work started modern man off in the wrong direction, the direction of philosophical idealism. Father John Hardin, whom we've quoted many times in our various series, writes that modern idealism, quote, is the theory that denies reality to the external physical world and attributes real existence only to things as they are in the mind. In its extreme form, it is pure subjectivism, denying existence to anything outside the mind of the thinking person, end of quote. One scholar said that Hobbes was a materialist who, and I'll quote from him, found in sense experience all the answers he needed, end of quote. And he goes on to say that this proud belief made Hobbes interpret the supernatural in the Bible and explain it in terms of natural processes, end of quote. His materialism led many of his contemporaries to believe that Hobbes was an atheist, but I would say that he was closer to being a deist. That is, one who believed that God designed and created the universe, but then stepped back to allow it to operate in accordance with the laws of nature that he had established without any interference. Contrary to what the Catholic Church has always taught, at least since St. Paul, he didn't believe that reason could tell us very much about God, including proof of his existence. In other words, Hobbes was a materialist who believed that the spirit world of souls, angels, and devils didn't exist. And he was a determinist who believed that all actions in the universe, including human actions, are determined by what went before.
So really denying free will.
Yes.
Okay. Well, how did his materialism, what is can be seen or touched or heard or tasted, how did that affect his views of interpreting the Bible?
Hobbes didn't believe that it could be proved the Bible is divinely inspired. He was one of the first to deny that Moses had written the Pentateuch. We talked about that, you might recall, in one of our sessions. He didn't say that divine revelation as found in the Bible was impossible. He simply argued that there was no possible way for one person to persuade another that God had actually revealed anything about himself. He also said that it was impossible to prove religious mysteries by a reasonable analysis. But he said that they could be accepted as long as they didn't disrupt society and government. In other words, as long as you keep it as a personal opinion or something like that.
Okay.
He was particularly concerned about social and political order, Hobbes was. Anybody knows Hobbes and his writings, that was some of the main subjects that he wrote about. He argued that the arguments of Catholics and Protestants who attempted to use religion to advance their causes against the claims of government were false.
Okay, so he certainly isn't in any way friendly to the church, either Catholic or Protestant.
That's true, yes. And, of course, by Protestant, it would primarily be the Anglican Church of England, of course, where he lived. Because arguments over religion could be so disruptive to the peace and order of a society, Hobbes maintained in his Leviathan, he's most famous for his book called The Leviathan, the sovereign's control of information was a vital part of his power, including control of the interpretation of the Bible. In other words, government censorship of the Bible or religion he was really advocating, because he felt like that religion could be very disruptive in a society to the order. Peace and order in the society.
So we're getting into that even now with, I believe, in Canada, they are thinking about it. They've already passed a law saying that the church cannot speak out. The government says the church cannot speak out against homosexuality or lesbianism because it's something like a hate crime.
Yeah, and that's sort of a Hobbesian view.
That the government has the right to tell the church what or what not. To say about the teaching of the Bible. And that's really a threatening danger in our society today. Okay.
Well, he argues, and I'll quote from him here, if some person or institution that was independent of the sovereign could speak authoritatively about what actions were necessary to heavenly redemption, the sovereign power would be significantly undermined, and his ability to keep order would be weakened. He's famous for a statement that he made one time that life is nasty, brutish, and short, if I recall right. It goes something like that. And that is man as he lived in a state of nature. And this idealistic period of time when supposedly men lived without order, without government. And that because things were, life was nasty and brutish and short during that period of time, that men sort of banded together and formed the state and formed government. And the only way you can keep peace is to have a sovereign, a Leviathan, who is so powerful that he can basically force people to be peaceful. To the extent that religion could be disruptive in the lives of people, the sovereign had to have control over and censorship over religion.
Okay, so he was the forerunner of dictatorship.
Essentially, yes.
Nazism or communism or Maoism.
To keep from, you know, chaos occurring, Hobbes would give the sovereign exclusive power to interpret scripture and to say which writings should be included in the Bible. In other words, in his particular case, it would have been the king. In England. Furthermore, of course, the sovereign could not control internal belief, but to maintain peace, every subject had to, quote, and this is quoting him, limit his public expressions in accordance with the sovereign's orders, end of quote. Since Hobbes considered conflict over religion so disruptive to public order, he, quote him again, hoped it would decrease in importance as science spread and people stop believing in invisible powers. In the meantime, he favored religious toleration to diminish the possibilities for conflict.
We favored religious toleration until the king would be able to exert his power to tell what books belonged in the Bible and what doctrines could or couldn't be taught.
Yeah, he was hoping that
it was a toleration thing.
Yeah, up to a point, but as long as it wasn't disruptive, In other words, all religions, let's be tolerant, let them all live together, not as long as they don't fight each other, as long as they don't have doctrinal differences that erupt into, disorder or any kind of chaos in society. But his hope was, in the long run, that religion would just sort of die out, sort of wither away.
Okay, now the reason we're spending time on this is because Hobbes had a great influence on many thinkers and on many people in government and the like at the time of this so-called Enlightenment. And it's obviously leads to chaos. Okay.
Yeah, Hobbes wrote quite a bit about the Bible, so I think that's how we got into here. Yeah, and that's why we're talking about it.
Yeah.
But we'll look at some philosophers who were not biblical scholars as such, but their way of thinking influenced biblical scholars.
All right. This would be true probably of René Descartes.
Yes.
How did he contribute to a change in biblical scholarship during the period of Enlightenment?
Well, as we said, he wasn't a biblical scholar himself as such, but his way of thinking contributed substantially to the way that the course that biblical scholarship was to take from then on, from after his time. It was René Descartes, who lived from 1596 to 1650, that philosophers began to abandon Aristotelian or Thomistic realism. Remember, we talked about realism in one of our earlier, another session. Although he considered himself a realist, Descartes held that universal ideas or knowledge comes to us directly from God, and we're going to not from our senses in contact with the material universe. Thomas Aquinas had taught much earlier that all knowledge first comes to us via the senses. That is, our ability to see and to, to hear
taste, touch, and smell.
Yes, that's where it all starts. Descartes' method of knowing truth is called innate ideas, which is the notion that spiritual ideas are not acquired from sense knowledge and reason, but are part of, our human nature, just the way we're made. They're innate. We're just born that way. The Catholic Church, at least since St. Thomas, has taught, and even before that, that humans possess innate ideas, but this doesn't mean that knowledge of God is not learned, as Father Hardin tells us. It means, quote, knowledge of God is said to be innate insofar as we can easily know his existence by means and principles that are innate in us. In other words, we can't know that God's innate. We're just not born that way. It's not infused into us by God. But we do have abilities. There are certain basic principles that are innate in us. And we're going to talk about some of those a little later, so we won't get into that now.
Well, like Paul, from the visible things of creation,
yes,
we come to a knowledge of our invisible Creator. So it's knowledge coming through the senses, and then it's actually in our mind, but it came through the senses, and God didn't infuse us with the idea that he exists.
And you might recall that we spent quite a bit of time in our series on Catholic apologetics, where we looked at issues such as that. Well, in other words, we can use our God-given reason or ability to think and come to the conclusion that God exists, especially by perceiving the things that he's made, as you mentioned a while ago. St. Paul, of course, very eloquently described that process. Descartes' system is a form of rationalism, which holds that reason can give certitude without experience or verification of facts. And by experience, again, we're talking about perception, we're talking about the senses, data outside of ourselves coming into our minds through our senses of seeing and hearing and tasting and touching and what have you. In other words, he would say that our knowledge of the world is acquired by use of reason, and that sensory input is inherently unreliable, more a source of error than knowledge. This is Descartes. Descartes spent a lot of, as I read him years ago, spent a lot of space, a lot of time explaining why the senses were inadequate to getting a good, precise understanding of what is outside of our minds. For example, a blind man is going to have a different conception of reality than people who can see. Okay. A person who's deaf will have, again, another perception of what's out there than someone, than people can hear. But it's not only that. It's not only just the senses in themselves, but it's preconceptions that we have.
As infused by God?
No, just preconceptions that we pick up, things that we learn from our family, things that could be an error, let's say, or whatever, all kinds of preconceptions that we have. We let these preconceptions determine how we see things as they come into us, as we see them, as we hear them, as we touch them, as we taste them, or whatever. The preconceptions can make us interpret the sensual data incorrectly.
Okay, now there seems to be a certain amount of truth in that.
Sure, there is.
So Descartes seems to be a very person with a great deal of conflictual ideas that he, as I understand from what you were saying, he's trying to defend religion, and yet he became the father of sort of pulling the rug out from underneath religion by his saying that we cannot attain reality outside.
I'm not sure that Descartes, I haven't studied Descartes enough to know that he really knew that even though he was trying to defend religion against skepticism, he was really contributing to further development of skepticism.
Apparently he wasn't trying to do that, but that's what happened.
That's correct.
Okay.
He lived in the 18th century, during the right in the middle of the so-called Enlightenment, 18th century France, and he was an ingenious mathematician who invented analytical geometry and a new application of algebra to geometry. Analytical geometry was. He also invented the Cartesian coordinates, or what we call the graph system. I guess that's the x, x, y, y premises that we can plot linear equations on in all kinds of fields. He was the inventor of that system, I understand. He had a vision of replacing the traditional philosophy, especially metaphysics, which had been developed by St. Augustine in the 4th century and refined by St. Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, which had lasted over 1,000 years. And metaphysics has been defined as a branch of philosophy that investigates the principles of reality that exist beyond any particular science. It is concerned with explaining the ultimate nature of being or existence and the world. I think that we can readily see why it fits in so nicely with theology. Descartes' goal was to, in other words, the philosophy of metaphysics, why it fits in so well with theology.
Okay.
Descartes' goal was to replace metaphysics with mathematics, which he considered a sure method of discovering truth. And he maintained that mathematics is as certain as it is because it is based on a few simple premises, so simple, in fact, that it is impossible to doubt them. For example, the shortest distance between points is a straight line. You know, anybody's had geometry, you know, you have your axioms and all that kind of thing that you have to, you start out in doing your reasoning process. We say they're self-evident.
Okay.
So if they're self-evident, that means they have to be innate. It has to be something that's a part of your mind, a part of the way your mind is constructed by God.
Well, and we can accept that.
Yes. Deducing conclusions from these certain premises, Descartes believed, would produce certain knowledge. Using this method, mathematicians had made great discoveries, he believed. He was right. He believed that if he could apply this method to non-mathematical knowledge, he would be able to refute the skeptics of his day. Many of them, of course, who were his colleagues. He argued that nothing could be known with certainty, and more importantly, provide a method with which to acquire certain knowledge of the world that could be used to benefit mankind in some way. Most of the scientists during this period were not atheists. Most of them believed that science could be used to glorify God, to understand God's beauty, His nature better, and at the same time could be applied, technologically speaking, to the benefit of humankind in some way or another. Using his method of methodological doubt, he called it methodological doubt, and mathematical physics, he hoped to reconstruct all knowledge and wisdom. In other words, he wanted to start out with all of the philosophy, the whole field of philosophy, and completely reconstruct it along these so-called mathematical lines.
And, of course, biblical scholarships, too?
Yes.
Okay.
They would apply to every field of knowledge, yes.
Okay. Methodical doubt. I doubt everything until I can prove it inside my own head.
And using, of course, reason. This is why it's called rationalism.
Okay.
As we'll see. Well, as we discussed in our series, the Da Vinci Code, what he did, in effect, was to eliminate final causation from the causes and things, leaving only material and efficient causes, thus separating science from religion and faith from reason. Well, after having considered knowledge acquired by sense experience, by dreaming, or by demonic suggestion, Descartes concluded it was unreliable. All of these things were unreliable. In other words, the senses or any knowledge we had by demonic dreams. He spent a lot of time giving examples of dreams and this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. How do we know that when we're dreaming, we're awake, and when we're awake, we're dreaming? You know, all that kind of thing. Okay. He gives a lot of examples of that. But nonetheless, because of the limitations of our senses, the unreality of our dreams, and the deception of demons. In each of these cases, the only thing that one could be certain of is that he is having the experience he is having. It's the only thing you can be certain of, the experience that you're having. And he concluded from this that one could know oneself as some kind of existing conscious being, that's all we could really know with certainty, that we are an existing conscious being. In other words, one can know with certainty that he exists because of his experiences, which led to his famous statement, "I think, therefore I am," or in Latin, cogito ergo sum. Very, very, very famous statement.
That's what he started to build on, his whole philosophy about how I can come to some kind of certainty. But I can't come to certainty. Now, here's where I get a little confused. By the use of reason?
No, it's pure reason that one comes to certainty.
So there's nothing coming from the outside.
Nothing coming from the outside. That's all unreliable.
It's all in my subjective, personal, in my head.
Because of the limitations of the senses, and as I said, he writes very extensively on that. Because of the preconceptions that we might have. That we filter, anything coming from outside of ourselves into our mind gets filtered through, which could be erroneous. Or any dreams that we might have could be misleading, or any kind of demonic suggestions or anything like that. So the only what he tried to start out with is the only thing that we can know with absolute certainty, and he concluded the only thing we can know with absolute certainty is our own existence. Our own consciousness of our existence. And that's where he started from there to build his whole system.
So he really started by wiping off the blackboard, the Bible, Revelation, anything from the creation. We can come to a knowledge of the Creator because we can't really trust our senses that something is out there.
They wiped out all natural theology, metaphysics. The whole thing, yes. He just said, start out with a clean slate, really.
Okay. Now, he was apparently a fairly religious man. How does this fit in? He's not trying to destroy religion?
Oh, no. He was trying to save it, really. He felt like that in the modern world, that scientists and philosophers and even theologians were becoming more and more skeptical for various reasons. I could think of a dozen reasons why, and we suggested a few of them in some of our earlier sessions.
So he's trying to invent come up with a new way to prove God's existence.
A mathematical, a scientific way of proving everything, not just God's existence, but everything. And so you have to start out with something you know is true. And so he's eliminated everything else. You see, under St. Thomas Aquinas and the Catholic Church before that.
And still.
Holds that There is a correspondence between what's in our mind and what's outside of our mind. Mm-hmm. And that as it filters, as it comes through the senses by our perception, we do have the ability within our soul, within our intellect, to use that in a way to understand that, to reason from the creation, God's beautiful creation and complex creation, to his existence. But Descartes, you see, is completely rejecting that whole idea that we can look at nature and then reason from that to God's existence.
Okay, so before we get into him being a religious man, which I just ask you, so I want to give you a chance to answer it, but really, the reason we're talking about this, because I think to an ordinary person, it sounds very illogical, nonsensical, no common sense, but it has greatly affected all our biblical studies even today and our thinking today.
Yeah, I've often thought of realism as common sense and idealism as nonsense.
Okay.
Meaning no sense.
Sure.
Which, of course, has its perceptual aspect, through the senses as well as the intellectual. A comment about Descartes. Yes, he was a very religious and pious man in a lot of ways. In fact, the latter part of his life, in fact, the last year of his life, he went to Sweden, and he was the tutor to Queen Christina of Sweden. Her father was Adolphus, what was his full name? He was a Lutheran king. Okay. He had to be a Lutheran to be the king of... This is after the Protestant Reformation, of course.
Okay.
And Adolphus, of course, led the Protestant forces in the third phase of the Protestant wars against the Catholics after the Protestant Reformation, the so-called 30 Years' War of the 17th century. Well, when she became queen, she was still a Protestant, and she brings Descartes to Sweden to be her private tutor. And poor old Descartes, he was used to living in warmer, sunny France, and... So these Swedish winters were a little bit hard on him. But she insisted that they get up at 5 o'clock or start, not get up. He had to get up about 4 o'clock and out of a cold bedroom and get ready and go in and teach her and her entourage philosophy from 5 o'clock till 12 o'clock every day. And he got sick in the process after about a year of it, and eventually ended up dying, I think, probably of pneumonia. But she converted to the Catholic faith, I think, inspired by Descartes. And she became a Catholic, and so she had to abdicate the throne and leave. In fact, she left Sweden and went to live the rest of her life in Rome. And is known for doing all kinds of really good, holy, being a very holy person and doing all kinds of good works.
Ron, you got some fascinating stories. We're going to have to continue with Descartes because our time is running out. And thanks again to our audience who have been listening to our 30th series on Understanding the Bible, a Catholic approach to interpreting sacred scripture. May God bless you always and in all ways.